Oh, 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 O'Reilly!
You need parts? O'Reilly Auto Parts has parts. Need them fast? We've got fast. No matter what you need, we have thousands of professional parts people doing their part to make sure you have it. Product availability. Just one part that makes O'Reilly stand apart. The professional parts people.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly! Auto Parts.
Hi, I'm Crystal Cheatham, and you are listening to On God's Campus, Voices from the Queer Underground, a podcast about white Christian supremacy and being queer on the most conservative campuses in the country. I'm here alongside my co-host, Aaron Green, the director of the Religious Exemption Accountability Project, to bring you a special episode, picking up where we left off with the new addition to the Elizabeth Hunter versus Department of Education lawsuit. Let's go. So last we left off, we were calling on students, staff, administrators, and the greater public to stand up for LGBTQ students.
Beloved students, rise up. Rise up like Kaylee at Lincoln Christian University. Rise up like Elizabeth at Bob Jones University. Rise up like Chloe at Seattle Pacific University. Speak your truth. Share your story on social media. Start a protest. Freedom.
Since then, there has been so much development over the Elizabeth Hunter versus Department of Education lawsuit. I'll let Aaron describe it.
In March of 2021, a group of LGBTQIA students harmed by Title IX exemptions filed a lawsuit against the Department of Education, challenging both the exemption itself and the government's application of the exemption to students like them in Elizabeth Hunter et al. Versus U.S. Department of Education. Represented by a team of attorneys at REAP and Perkins Coie, an international law firm, the students litigated their case in federal court for nearly 2 years until the judge assigned to the case dismissed their lawsuit in January 2023, just last year. The court held that even though the plaintiffs had sufficiently demonstrated that the harm they had suffered was a result of the U.S. government's implementation of the religious exemption to Title IX, that they had not alleged sufficient facts to state a legal claim for which relief could be granted to them. The Hunter plaintiffs appealed the decision and in August 2023 filed their opening brief before the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals with amicus support from numerous individuals and organizations, including 19 state attorneys general. And with Perkins Coie as lead counsel on the appeal, the case is now fully briefed and the legal team is preparing for oral argument before the Court of Appeals on July 16th, which just happened last week.
Three things stood out to us during the amicus briefing. The first was a moment when the Council for Christian Colleges denied there ever being exemptions made on Christian campuses for gender-based violence.
Well, first of all, Your Honor, I'm not aware of any religious school that has claimed an exemption from Title IX with respect to gender-motivated violence or those kinds of things. I haven't seen that, and the plaintiffs didn't present any evidence that any school had ever sought such an exemption. So I think that's really a red herring.
The second was a devastating moment when the Department of Education said this.
The government does not dispute that LGBTQ individuals have faced and continue to face discrimination, and the government does not condone discriminatory acts. But under binding Supreme Court precedent, that historic discrimination does not trigger intermediate scrutiny.
Lastly, this powerful moment when Aletta Brenner, lead counsel for Perkins Coie, was able to interject into the contentious discussion a story about plaintiff Kaylee Hargrove.
I didn't find any allegations that showed that any of these individual plaintiffs were harmed by the 2020 rule change. Did I miss something?
There were not detailed facts pulled together in the operative complaint, but there are a number of facts that came
through. There have to be to have standing and causation, right?
There would have to be some facts, general injury facts at least. And general injury was alleged, but there are many more facts that the plaintiffs could have added had they had the opportunity. So, for example, one of the plaintiffs, Kaylee Hargrove, and I'm sorry, I'm running out of time, but I'll respond to your question.
You can finish answering my question.
Yes. So Kaylee Hargrove was a military veteran who was going to school on the GI Bill. Kaylee saw that her school was a Title IX school, believed that meant that she had legal protections. It was a reasonable inference because that school had never before sought an exemption and there was nothing on OCR's website about it. Kaylee didn't find out until after she had undergone a gender transition and was well on her way to getting her degree, when the school then told her basically, you're going to be expelled if you don't leave. And Kaylee at the very last minute then had to transfer schools, was delayed in her time to graduation, and was very much affected. And given the timing of when Kaylee was at school and when those things were happening, Kaylee would have benefited from the prior rule had the department had that rule and enforced it.
Vis-a-vis the 2020 rule change, when did all this happen? Before, after, during what?
Today, Aaron and I bring you two of the plaintiffs from the lawsuit. What you are going to listen to is a discussion that happened shortly after the appeal. We wanted to know what that moment meant for Kaylee Hargrove, a writer, theologian, and director of digital outreach for the Center for Prophetic Imagination, and Lucas Wilson, a writer, editor, and a Justice, Equity, and Transformation postdoctoral fellow at the University of Calgary. Let's listen in.
So we are now having this conversation about the reactions and responses to the appeal, which took place last Tuesday. It was an interesting set of events with no decision made at that time. But I'm here with Kaylee Hargrove, a plaintiff in the case, and Lucas Wilson, plaintiff in the case. And we are going to discuss some things regarding our feelings about this and what kind of impact this case has had for LGBTQ students going to religious universities with Title IX exemptions, and those universities still receive public funding, even though they're legally allowed to discriminate against these students.
Thank you, Aaron. And I just want to welcome you all here. Aaron Green, who is the director of REAP, Kaylee Hargrove, and Lucas, I'm sorry, I don't remember your last name, Wilson, Lucas Wilson. So last week, we were fortunate enough to actually watch the appeal online. And we also did some live tweeting. And I know that before everything happened, Kaylee, you were able to release a video just talking about your feelings and how frustrated you were with everything that's happening. To all three of you, what are your first reactions after the appeal, that it happened at all? And if you were able to witness it, like, you know, how you were processing it?
I'll go. I was watching it to live tweet it with Crystal. I also watched when the preliminary injunction happened. I listened to the testimony of the students during that process as well. So this entire thing has been so interesting. And to watch the government, the Department of Education, basically say that they have no responsibility in the harm that's been caused to queer, trans, and non-binary students on these campuses who are claiming and saying and proving. And sidebar, we have clinical evidence that this happens. We have evidence and proof that just having non-affirming language is harmful to queer, trans, and non-binary folks. Anyway, it's pretty wild to watch our government try to defend themselves against this claim, right? The other thing that I really loved was Aletta Brenner at Perkins Coie. What a badass. Just going after the government. It was a thing to watch. It was so cool. I think you can still go back and watch it on the Ninth Circuit website. So if anybody hasn't been able to see it and wants to see it and see Aletta Brenner in action, it was a sight to see. And I was very, very happy that she was representing y'all in this case. I thought that was very cool. So that was my initial reaction to it.
Kaylee, how did you feel?
Yeah, it was... honestly, it was a little bit difficult up front because our lawyer or representation went first, and it was very much the judges bringing questions about just different things. In a, so it felt kind of like we were being attacked, like right up front. But then they yes. turned around and did it to the defense as well. So it did end up coming across very balanced. The things that stuck out to me was just the simple fact of, like, one, the Department of Education admitted that students are being discriminated. And basically what they said was, we don't have to do anything because it doesn't trigger the Supreme Court's decision Basically, they said, we don't have to do anything about it. We acknowledge that this is happening. We don't have to do anything about it. And so we're not. And that's really where they are, which in a lot of ways should really highlight the fact that this is an intentional decision on the Department of Education, because they're saying, yeah, we know this exists, but because the Supreme Court hasn't told us that we have to change it, we're not going to. So this is an intentional decision. And it should also be noted just the fact that this isn't necessarily tied to a single administration, because this lawsuit started from events that happened under the Trump administration. And I think possibly even the lawsuit was filed while Trump was still president, but I'm not, that was over 4 years ago. So it's, I don't necessarily remember the timeline, and I wasn't one of the first plaintiffs on it. I came in later. So I wasn't there at the beginning. So I don't know when the actual start was, but so it started, at least the majority of the events that started the case came under Trump. I believe the lawsuit was filed under Trump, but it's been going on for almost 4 years under the Biden administration. So this is not like one party is against queer people, the other party is for them. It's both parties like setting up their administration and making this decision that we are going to continue to fund schools that discriminate against queer people. And we're going to make the decision to keep it that way. That's so literally what is being said when the Department of Education admits that there is discrimination.
Yeah, it's very disheartening. It's extremely disheartening. Kaylee, when you first started speaking, you talked a little bit about how you were feeling. And, you know, Perkins Coie, you were the only plaintiff that they were whose story they were able to bring up during the everybody's talks. And so I'm wondering if each of you, maybe starting with Kaylee, can tell us about the emotional impact of this whole thing being presented in a court, because it's your stories.
I was emotional. I was like walking around actually listening to it, and which is like my earbuds. And when they got to my story, it was really emotional, like just to feel heard, to have my story not just be what is being heard, but be a story that can be used to highlight a lot of the wrong that has happened. And some of the things that were said by the defendants, because the Department of Education apparently decided, well, maybe it's the Department of Justice that like represented them, whoever, the government decided to yield their 20 minutes, 5 minutes each to two different organizations. One is the Alliance Defending Freedom. A known hate group.
Heritage is for some other bad stuff going on right now.
Yeah. I mean, they work together, honestly. So it's, but they're a known hate group. And then also the CCCU had a chance to speak, and they made some wild claims that didn't hold up. They made, like, one of them said that there, to his knowledge, there had not been, a use of the Title IX religious exemption for gender-based sexual harassment, which is either a complete lie or he is completely misinformed, because the truth of the matter is Baylor was given an exemption to sexual harassment. My story qualifies as gender-based sexual harassment based off of the Department of Education's definition of sexual harassment. So the fact that they're saying that is just completely wrong. And so to be able to highlight my story and show that, like, this is stuff that is happening, you can't just go into a courtroom and say, we have no knowledge of this. Like, no, that's not how this is supposed to work. The truth is they do have knowledge. The person speaking was from the CCCU. They have knowledge. They are the ones that give the legal information to these schools to fill out their exemptions, to like jump through the loopholes. Like, they know these things are happening. That Baylor is one of the organizations that they help, and Baylor got a sexual harassment exemption. Like, it's so just messed up. And I'm hoping the judges notice that. And I know that the oral arguments are a small part of like the amount of briefings that have been filed and things like that. So we'll see what happens.
We will see what happens.
Yeah.
You know,
this makes me think of a question, because that point that Kaylee brought up, and Lucas, I would love to hear your take on this, and Kaylee. Well, why is it so hard for these schools to just admit and say, I'm sorry, like, yes, we've hurt LGBTQIA students, and that's not okay. What is it about Christianity, or what is it about their theology or ideologies, that prevents them from just saying, you know what, we screwed up here, we missed the mark, right? And let's do a better job. What's up with that? Why is it so difficult, do you think?
I think that in evangelicals, or, well, it's not just evangelicals, right? We're talking about an entire, you know, any sort of religiously affiliated college or university, that within their theological imagination, and I would put the emphasis on imagination, these folks don't believe that we exist, right? That they don't believe there's such thing as homosexuality in the terms that in the sense that we use the term, right? That they don't believe that we are gay. They don't believe that we are trans. They don't believe that we are lesbians. They don't believe we are, you know, queer. They believe that we are folks who are struggling, quote unquote, with same-sex attraction, again, quote unquote, and or gender identity, quote unquote, issues, right? So I think that within their framework, we're not intelligible. We are not actually within that frame of reference because we fall beyond that. And so they try to make sense of us, who again, fall beyond their really limited sort of circumscribed definition of, sexual beings. And as a result, they don't think that we actually exist. I don't think that they actually believe that we are queer. I don't think that they actually believe that we are trans. They don't believe these things. And so therefore, they're not going to accept harm done to us because we are just latent or potential heterosexuals that are quote unquote struggling, and they believe they have the solution, right? They believe that what they're doing, whether it be conversion therapy, whether it be conversion practices more broadly, that these different sort of approaches to us and ways of dealing with us and fixing us are the ways that they should be operating. And so I think that they don't see it as harm. In the upside down world of the new Christian right and, you know, similar religious traditions, that they see what they're doing to be loving and compassionate. So if what they're doing is loving and compassionate, they're not going to accept fault. They're not going to accept blame. Why? Because they're simply doing what God told them to do in their estimation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which is...
Yeah, into.
This blows my mind because it's like, and growing up in the evangelical church and I've, you know, y'all know I went to Azusa Pacific University, led a queer underground movement at Biola. So I know what it feels like. But it's so strange to me that when we say this hurts, this doesn't feel good to the people that we were made to feel and believe that we could trust in, you know, and they turn around and basically gaslight us and say, no, this doesn't hurt you. This is for your good because we love you.
One of the crazy, crazy things that I read in their amicus brief was that they were claiming that LGBTQ people on their campuses were better off than those on non-affirming campuses. And I'm like, y'all are just pulling things out of your butt at this point. Like, how can you claim that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, Kaylee, what were you going to say?
Yeah, I was just going to add to what Lucas said. It goes beyond just the belief that we don't exist. It is in the belief that the part of us that seems to exist is the consequences of sin, or depending on your theology, the fall from the beginning. I mean, I was raised not Calvinist, so I wasn't taught original sin per se, but still, like, being queer, being trans, whatever, is the consequences of sin and depravity. So the fact is, if they do something against us because we're queer or we're trans or whatever, it's not their fault, because it was our sin that put us in that situation. So it's actually our fault. And I mean, once you start using that entire framing, you can go a lot of horrible, horrendous places. And in fact, we have seen that throughout history. We've seen that throughout things like the Inquisition. We've seen that through Nazi Germany, that actually targeted queer people, especially trans people, first. That we can see that throughout just different periods of Christian history, where it is believed that you can cause enough violence to a person that they will repent or they'll die. And if they die, that's on them, because they didn't repent, right? This is the history of Christianity that a lot of evangelicals want to think that they're better than, but they're not. They're still founding their theology on the past theology that got them there, and they don't understand the fact that those are the theology they have today was built on the concept of violence against other people, which is super weird, because I am still a Christian, even though I am trans. Like, the idea is that I can't be Christian because I am trans, right? But it's this entire theology of violence against a non-Christian person or somebody that they believe can't be Christian will, in fact, either one, get them to repent and convert, or they'll end up dying and not be a bad influence, but that's on them because they didn't repent and convert. And this is Christian history throughout European culture.
That is such an intensely pure and rich thing to know about what it means to be Christian. What a rich fact about Christianity, because that kind of, like, war mentality that you have to die for this goes both ways, because it's also like, I have to die for this, right? Like, there's nothing else. It's life or death, matter both ways. Which makes me want to ask, so the defense was arguing that hundreds of schools across America will need to close if they are forced to be affirming in order to receive Title IX benefits.
Up, that's a lie.
Will they, you know? But, like, I guess the question is, like, what is the solution, or what is the end game, or are you okay with this if they do clothes, right? Or are you okay with schools?
I mean, so the thing is we're talking about federal funding. We're not talking about religious expression. This isn't even about religious expression. This is telling the federal government, hey, you shouldn't be paying people that aren't going to follow your rules, right? Like every other funding thing out there, if you break the rules, you don't get the money. We just want the Department of Education to do that. If schools want to keep discriminating against queer students because they believe it's part of their religion, they can exist in that space. They just shouldn't be getting federal money, because the federal government has said that they're going to protect queer students, and they're not. So they're lying about that.
Yeah.
Because you can't have exemptions to protection, right? Like, that's so messed up. But if they close the doors, that's on them. They are choosing to discriminate. If they're choosing to discriminate and not get federal funding, that's on them. if they decide to stay open and stop discriminating, or to keep receiving money and stop discriminating, that's also on them. It's up to them to follow the rules. We're just saying, hey, they should have to follow the rules.
Right. It's that simple. It's that simple. Lucas, what do you think about these schools potentially closing if they don't follow, you know, Title IX, or don't comply with Title IX law?
I say yes and amen. I mean, I think about a number of schools. So I went to Liberty University, which is the largest of these schools, unfortunately, because
my condolences, that, by the way, my condolences.
Received, and thank you. It's a school that has an unbelievable amount of influence in the wider culture, not just within the evangelical world. Even if you think about Project 2025, this is one of the institutions that has contributed to the writing and the drafting of Project 2025. And so on just that alone, I think this should give us, you know, offer us pause and think about the influence and the impact that these schools have beyond their campuses. I mean, Liberty has what's called the Standing for Freedom Center. It's an evangelical think tank, which I think is a contradiction in terms. But nonetheless, this is an institution that mobilizes a lot of really awful speech, specifically about trans folks, but also about queers, but also about what they fear, critical race theory, and their misunderstanding, obviously, and misinformation about queer critical race theory. And again, take your pick on any one minority. If you're queer, if you're a woman, if you're whatever, this institution, this again think tank, quote unquote, is spewing out this hatred. So I think to myself, if this were to be a school that closed, hallelujah, right? Like, yeah. I think that this is something that would be a blessing to the world, let alone, you know, the U.S. And for me, you know, I think to myself about the damage that's being done. Because yes, Liberty might be the largest, but it's certainly not the only one, right? That it's certainly not the only one that has, you know, in-house conversion therapists. It's not the only one that actively discriminates against queer students, that within their policy now, it directly names not just LGBTQ students, but those who have, and I quote, LGBT states of mind, end quote. Whatever the hell that means. But of course, what that means is that it broadens the definition of not just queer students that they can discriminate against, but those who actually advocate for them, those who are allies, those who support them. And so it's these kinds of schools that if they were to close, I think it would only be a service to the rest of the U.S. and again, the world.
Dang, mic drop. Okay.
I think it's important to note that in and of itself is not what the lawsuit's about. Because these are personal opinions. I would love to see most of them. I don't think discrimination has a place in American culture, but it does exist. But the lawsuit isn't about that. The lawsuit is about federal money going to places that discriminate. So we need to be clear about that, because that's one of the things that some of these. I don't know. I've had articles written specifically about me saying that I'm going after religious freedom. No, that's not it. We're going after is federal funding whenever places are discriminating.
So
government should follow rules. Sorry.
Yeah, no, I keep interrupting you. So on that point, are you okay with schools that don't receive federal funding but are blatantly non-affirming? Like, they have their own religion. They're not receiving federal funding. They're existing on their own out there. Is that the American way?
I think what Kayla just said makes so much sense, right? It's like, you can absolutely discriminate, not saying you should. In fact, we're saying you probably shouldn't. And by probably shouldn't, you absolutely shouldn't. However, if you are to receive taxpayer dollars, then you cannot discriminate. And again, you have to, as Kayla said, follow the rules. And they're not difficult rules, right? Like, these are not sort of like, you know, they don't have to perform any sort of like, strenuous labor or gymnastics in order to follow these rules. It is very simple. In the same way, you cannot discriminate on the basis of racial identity. You should not be able to discriminate on the basis of sexual identity and gender identity and expression, right? Like, it's not difficult. And so, yes, I do think if I am to be the person that advocates for everyone to have an opinion. And I do think everyone should be allowed to have an opinion, not saying all opinions are good and not all opinions should be shared. In fact, most opinions I think should not be shared after hearing what I've heard. But, you know, I think to myself, you should absolutely be able to have that opinion. But if you have that opinion, then you should not be receiving federal funding. It's as simple as that.
I think it's pretty wild. Yeah. I think it's pretty wild right now that there are all of these schools trying to catch up with Biden's rules for Title IX because of what happened during Trump's, I want to say reign, but I'll say administration with Betsy DeVos and her. And then comes the Biden administration and kind of like course corrects. And there are quite a few states that have been able to kind of wiggle out of it and not make their schools abide by it. But the majority of them have to. The majority of these schools in these states are secular, right? And so it just feels really weird. It feels icky that only the secular schools are the ones having to figure out whether or not or how they're going to be more, you know, aware of sexual harassment, LGBTQ people, and you know, pregnant students.
Yeah, and it so like Lucas said, it is that simple, right? You take public money, you follow public law. Period. It's that simple. That's all that I believe. I hope I'm correctly representing all that. That's what this lawsuit is asking for.
It's absolutely what the lawsuit is.
Okay. Which is, I mean, it's common sense, right? Like, it's not that hard. And hey, I want to sidebar something that Lucas was talking about with Project 2025 and Liberty. I don't want to take us too far off the rails, but when it comes to following laws and rules, how do they have a tax exempt status and are still able to politically lobby Project 2025 or be a whatever they are, you know, a designer of this project and still receive the kind of benefits that they do? I don't know. Question for, you know, another time.
It's because they're not endorsing a specific candidate.
That's how they get away with it.
They don't say Trump in it, even though people have hinted at it from the sidebars, but it's not stated in it. But one thing that we do need to talk about is the fact that Liberty University's actions, especially in regard to Project 2025, meets the Southern Poverty Law Center's definition of a hate group.
Yes.
Liberty University 100% fits the definition of a hate group and should be recognized as such.
I agree. We've contacted the Southern Poverty Law Center to have Liberty designated as a hate group in the past. We should have this conversation again with them because that was a couple of years ago, you know, and a lot has transpired since then. So I don't want to get too off the rails since then.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I know they have. Yeah. It's just fun, like fun extra fodder.
That's a coming podcast. We'll talk about that.
that's another episode for another time for sure.
You know, I love that we are recording this on the heels of President Biden bowing out of the race and VP Kamala Harris kind of stepping up, because I just want to talk a little bit about the future of this fight. You know, the appeal started just another round of, I know you guys have been going through this for a while, just another round of the fight, but like, what would you love the future administration to do in regards to Title IX, like specifically?
Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.
Well, first, I want to say the Biden administration kind of did a course correction, but they also didn't. They had a chance and they failed to do it. The process of getting a religious exemption can still be done after a complaint is made, which is ridiculous. There's no explanation as to why that should be a thing. The first revisions to Title IX's implications didn't include anything about transgender students, and the newest ones are still too vague. And the thing is the Supreme Court's decision in 2020 that said that gender identity and sexual orientation are covered under the basis of sex. The fact is, the Biden administration is almost just trying to slowly implement the Supreme Court's decision, and it should have been settled. Like the Biden administration should have just came out and said, no, there's no discrimination under Title IX for this. There can't be trans bathroom bans. There can't be bans on women's sports, because that is discrimination on the basis of sex as defined by the Supreme Court. And the fact is, it might have been a little bit of a course correction, but it was still still conservative implementation of Title IX. No, like regardless of how you look at it. I am hoping that a new administration will understand the fact that being slow about this just increases the hateful rhetoric about queer people. Like, you're pulling the Band-Aid slowly, and the entire time people get to get upset and yell and say awful, terrible things, jump into my emails to tell me that I'm going to hell and I should kill myself. Like, these are things that are happening because our political system is set up to move so slow. And instead of being like, no, we're done with this, they're stretching it out. And that's incredibly harmful. So I'm hoping that a new administration going in a direction that I personally want will see that and be brave enough to actually do the job of trying to end discrimination. Like, that shouldn't be hard.
And I think that in addition to like everything that Kelly just said, I agree with. And I think in addition to that, by being slow, they are jeopardizing the safety of so many queer students right now, right? Like, until this is solved or fixed or addressed, then those who are there right now will suffer, right? And for me, I agree with everything Kelly said, and I think I would even go beyond it. For me, I think religious exemptions, no matter what context they're in, I think should be absolutely just done away with. The idea that a religion, it supersedes others' rights, like fundamental human rights as people, not just as religious people, but as sort of like, you know, the aspects of what make up our identity, like our sexuality, our gender, our race, these sorts of, you know, parts of who we are, that somehow religion is over and above or is privileged over and above those aspects of our identity is bonkers. And I think to myself that there should be no religious exemptions. I come from Canada. I am Canadian. And I am not American. So this, of course, comes from a different perspective. But what I will say is that, like, no matter what, like, there should not be religious exemptions for anything, whether it be taxation or the context that we're fighting for in this court case, right? Like, the fact that churches receive, exemptions for taxes is crazy to me, right? Like, how in the world in 2024, when we have so many different religious traditions, and also those who are not religious, why would religions or religious organizations be receiving some sort of benefit like that? It does not make sense to me. And so for me, I say yes to everything that Kelly's saying, and I would say even beyond that, that there should not be such thing as a religious exemption. I think it's cuckoo to me.
You guys,
yeah. I want to add to that. Oh, sorry.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I just want to add to what Lucas just said, because it's even more sinister than that, because it's not just that they're prioritizing a religious belief over like the law, right? It's actually the fact that they are prioritizing the religious belief of institutions over individuals, which an institution is not a person. My religious beliefs say that it is not sinful for me to be trans, right? But the institution said that it was. And so the government is literally siding with the institution's religious beliefs. An institution can't have beliefs. It's not a sentient being. So there is a prioritization of religion over law, but there is also the prioritization of Okay, I'm going to just be honest. There's a prioritization of the white cishet religion over queer beliefs. That's just how it is. And we have to recognize that as...
Absolutely, yes.
Yeah.
I mean, I echo all of this. I have, you know, that y'all said it beautifully. I don't need to add anything to that. I think that was very articulate and yeah, to the point.
I would say that you guys are all just like so passionate about what's happening. And, you know, the last time, I mean, when I first came to REAP, you know, almost 2 months ago. And at the start, I had the privilege of on the website, there is a timeline of this entire case when it started and back to back every single little thing that has happened. And you guys have been in this fight for a long time and still you are passionate. And I can't imagine how it just hasn't rolled over into burnout. And so my question is, what keeps you motivated to continue this fight? You can just say anger. That also works.
I mean, personally, I do take breaks from focusing on this case, just because it's a slow process. The legal system can be very slow. So there's a few months where I just zone out and kind of not even think about it because it's a slower process. And then things happen, like the oral arguments come up. And so it's like, oh, it's time to step in gear on this topic and focus on it. That has not been as easy the last few months, just because I am now on the board of REAP. So I'm thinking about REAP probably more than I was before. But at the same time, like, it's hard to see just the sheer injustice that is happening around us. And it's so interconnected. The fact that there is a religious exemption that exists is tied to the way that the religious right is trying to take away or did take away DEI because of some, basically it's white belief systems. White supremacy is the reason for injustice against Black people, people of color, Indigenous people, and also queer people, because at the center of it, like, we got our understanding of human sexuality through a Roman colonized European understanding, and we decided that we reached the peak of knowledge of humanity. And so because of that, we have to force it on everybody. So queerness is discrimination against queerness is in fact just so tied to white supremacy and injustice and colonization that has happened around the world. And there is no escaping it. So you're either fighting it or you're drowning in it. And there's really not too many choices sometimes whenever it comes to like, why do you keep going? Well, if I don't keep going, then I'm going to be drowning in all of the injustice. So
I think it's, I mean, of course, this lawsuit is part of a larger struggle, which is of course queer liberation that didn't, you know, end, once back in the 70s or the 80s and the 90s. It's something that's going to continue, and it's going to continue throughout our lives. Right. And I think that this is one piece of the puzzle for us to continue to fight. And so for me, like, one of the metaphors that Haley just used was colonization, right? That this is a form of colonization. I think there's another metaphor we can use, but it's not actually a metaphor. It's actually, to use the word in a very literal sense, is genocide. That if these folks could have their way, queer people would not exist, right? That if they could choose to have a world without queers, that's the world they would prefer. And so what are they doing? They're fighting for that world. They're fighting to create that world. They're doing their best to get rid of us. And so it's very much in a literal sense, in the sense of a cultural genocide, that is absolutely their desire to get rid of queerness. And so I don't think that's, and there's research to back this up, right? This isn't an original idea. This is something that is peer-reviewed research. But on top of that, even if it's not peer-reviewed research, the fact remains, right? Like, on a very basic level, they don't want us. And so for us to be a part of this lawsuit, I think that's part of the puzzle to fight against this. And so for me, I think about specifically you know, again, I've been listening to a lot of, you know, folks talk about Project 2025 recently, and thinking about the potential. And again, I don't live in the U.S., but being a neighbor of the U.S. is terrifying if, in fact, that administration is Trump, right? And especially Trump following the guided rubric of 2025. And so for me, I want to see that our lawsuit is successful, and I want to see that, you know, queer liberation continues and queer life flourishes, and that they, the other, essentially those who are against us don't win the fight, right? And so for me, what keeps me going is just the fact that, you know, if we don't fight, then very quickly our rights that have been so painstakingly won will be reversed very quickly and very easily. Under an administration that seeks our demise and our erasure.
Well said. Well said.
Wow. I am like blown away by y'all. I'm not a part of the lawsuit, but of course I am, as the director of REAP and as someone who's been doing this kind of work for about 9 years now. Of course I want to see, like Lucas and Kaylee have talked about, queer liberation in every space imaginable, especially religious spaces. But I mean, I guess I do this because once I realized, like when I had that cathartic moment for myself, when I realized God is perfectly okay with me being queer, whether or not you believe that God does or does not exist, like for me, I do. So once I realized that that was okay, I'm cool, like queer people are awesome, we're rad, like once I had that realization, and I knew, like I knew that this was something to defend, to protect, to uphold. There's no other choice to me in my mind. There's no other decision to be made but to continue in this fight. Because we are whole ass human beings. We are valid. We have dignity. We deserve love and all those things. We deserve every opportunity and every advantage that everybody else has, whether they're straight or queer or whatever the hell. And if you're paying tens of thousands of dollars to go to an academic institution, then damn it. I don't care what kind of institution it is. You deserve to have an equitable and safe learning environment just as much as the straight person sitting next to you. And if they're willing to take our money, then they should also be willing to protect us under the same protections that straight people have. They have and I think this was talked about in the case at some point, a fiduciary responsibility. And that doesn't get talked about a whole lot. What kinds of responsibilities do the institution have? Does the institution have to, you know, what are they beholden to when it comes to the care and protection of the people attending its classes and lectures and living their lives for 4+ years, 8 years sometimes on these little cities? Cause that's what they are, you know? Anyway, that's what I think.
Fiduciary, that's a word I don't hear quite often enough. But Aaron.
Here we go. $1 million word. Yeah, fiduciary.
No, I think my heart's there as well. Kaylee and Lucas, both of you were students on one of these campuses. And my experience is that as well. I hadn't even come out till like right near my graduation day, but on my campus I heard all kinds of discussions about, you know, homosexuality and queer folk and everything, and I have been able to continue to be a Christian, and you know, I feel like because of what happened to me shortly after my graduation, my entire life was kind of truncated and thrown into a different course. And, you know, here you are today continuing to fight, but with the memory of who you were on that campus, it'll never leave you. I guess. So my question is, where are you now professionally? And are you still a Christian? And did your school, what happened to you, strip you of the future you envisioned for yourself?
I think that, yeah, the school did strip me of what I wanted to do. I wanted to go become a professor, specifically of Old Testament, Hebrew Bible, however you want to say it. Yeah, that's kind of, I was wanting to work up through my tradition and kind of be adjacent to my tradition. The fact is, the independent Christian church doesn't have a denominational hierarchy and they don't have set doctrines. So being expelled from school is basically the same as being excommunicated, like in the way that you're going to be viewed. I'm not going to say that it's necessarily a bad thing at this point, because I don't necessarily want to be teaching in a tradition like that. But like that was my plan. I did have to shift. While I was there, I was starting to realize that wasn't going to be a possibility anyways. I was at least out to myself for a little bit of time while I was enrolled in school. And like, I took a missions class and we spent an entire 2 weeks on how to be missionaries to the LGBTQ plus community. Stop. And no, this is serious. And some of the things that were being said in it were just absolutely disgusting. And like talking about queer people as being this entirely other community or entirely other culture. And not only that, like, because it was an online course, we had discussion times. And so like, I brought up, like, I didn't want to, I was getting to the point where I just wanted to graduate and move on. But I was just like, why are we talking about the LGBTQ plus community as like this completely separate culture whenever it's actually the rejection of our predominantly Christian culture that has led to the separation? That's really not a healthy way to look at it, because it's our fault for creating that. But then on top of that, there were, I think, three people in the class, and this class is not big, that had mentioned that they, two of them were girls and one of them was a guy, and they talked about how they were, they were queer, but they were like, they weren't saying it outright. They would phrase it in like same sex attraction type thing. And it was so hard to read those discussions, because the religion was stripping them of so much joy in who they could be. And they were feeling like still being ashamed of who they were and trying to cover it up and trying to change. And then at the same time, you have like a guy that was going in to be a military chaplain. So, you know, go help with the spirituality of, you know, the troops, right? Talking about how he wouldn't do a gay wedding as a chaplain in the military. And it's like, your job is to be there for the troops, but you're going to discriminate against people that are fighting for your freedom. And like, that is messed up. And I was sitting there as a military vet, like just, I think that term I had just, got discharged from the military. And it was just so, it was disgusting. The entire culture was so toxic to queer people that I'm going to try to bring this back to the original question, that I did shift and I've been able to get into advocacy, and I work for a nonprofit now that integrates spirituality and social justice and advocacy. I've been able to use that time, like on the clock time, if you want to put it that way, to show up and speak to politicians at capitals. I've been able to speak at events and things like that. So it's allowed me to use the education that I have, because I do so much theology in basically all of my speeches and things like that, but use it in a way that is hopefully making change. And this might not have been something that I would have gotten into if this didn't happen to me. So it sucks. And I do still have like trauma in responses to these Christian spaces because of what happened. But at this also, I've been able to take the incredibly negative experience and turn it into something, at least resembling something positive. So we'll see once, when I get further down the road, how much my advocacy has created change. But it takes everybody putting forth their voice and to bring forth change. So I'm happy that I get to be one of those people.
They really think that they're like dousing a small fire, but what they're doing is like creating a wildfire. You know, like it's not water, it's gasoline. It's just, you know, we don't go away. We don't go anywhere. We just keep growing. Yeah. And being able
also, I stepped on you there. But Lincoln Christian University closed the doors this year, and they sold their seminary to Ozark Christian College because they got so much bad press that they had people drop out of their school. They weren't doing well financially anyways, but they had people drop out and had fewer people applying because they found out how terrible it was. And in one of their press releases, they literally blamed the next generation from not upholding Christian values as one of their reasons why they were having to do things. So like, some of these places are shooting themselves in the foot, and I couldn't be happier about that.
Lucas, I want to give you a chance to answer that same question. Are you still a Christian, and did your school strip you of your future, the future you saw for yourself?
So I didn't grow up in the church. I became a Christian in high school. An evangelical tradition in Canada that's really similar to the Southern Baptist Convention. And I went to Liberty, and I was at Liberty for all 4 years. And I'm assuming, similar to most of the school or the students who represented this case in their schools, heard a lot of really anti-queer messaging my entire time there. I went through 4 years of conversion therapy there. And when I graduated, I wanted to go to grad school, largely because I felt that if I didn't, no one would take my degree seriously, because I went to Liberty University. So I was like, I need to legitimate this degree by going and doing my master's. And so I did. And then I got caught up in academia, and I thought to myself, wow, I really like this. I want to go learn more. And so I went to divinity school at Vanderbilt, and Vanderbilt's very much like a progressive seminary, it's a divinity school. And in fact, when I applied there, they interviewed me. And I remember when I got the interview, the email about the interview, I thought to myself, there's nowhere on the website that says they want to interview, like that they require an interview, but something must be wrong. And sure enough, something was wrong. And the Dean of Admissions, Catherine Smith, who's now at Duke, she pops on that, I think it was Skype at the time. She says, I'm going to cut straight to the chase. We just don't really understand why you're applying since you went to Liberty University. And I was like, oh, shoot. And I had to explain it. You know, I said, I thought I made this clear in my application materials, but obviously I didn't. So I had to, you know, clarify a wee bit more. And then I went to Vandy, and it was there that I really wanted to figure out. At that point, I wanted to figure out my faith, how to reconcile my faith and my sexuality. I wanted to understand, like, is it possible to be a Christian and be gay? And I found out the answer that absolutely it is. It's 100% possible. But for me, I continued studying what I was studying at the time. And most of my research in the past was on the Holocaust, and looking actually at the Christian foundations of the Holocaust, and how Christian theology and scripture itself have been used in such a way, or were used in such a way, that ultimately the Holocaust happened. But then I started looking at the aftereffects of the Holocaust, and I started looking at intergenerational trauma. All this to say, I was researching the Holocaust, and it was there that I really lost my faith. And I think that the faith that I had, though, after Liberty, was definitely shaped in a way that it was emboldened, right? It was emboldened, and it was all the more anti-queer. You know, of course, we have so much internalized homophobia for those of us who were in the church or grew up in the church, or, you know, became a part of the church when I, you know, for me at age 14 or whatever. And I don't think that the faith that I had when I lost it was worth keeping. I'm absolutely one person. I'm thinking to myself, if you're a Baptist, cool, be a great Baptist. If you're a Presbyterian, cool, be a great Presbyterian. If you're a Catholic, whatever. Like, I'm not anti-religion. I, for me, it's like, do you, right? But, and in the same way, if you're an atheist, you do you. Like, it just doesn't matter to me. But what I do, what does matter to me is that whoever is religious and whoever's not religious does it well. And so for me, I went on and did my PhD, and then I did my postdoc, my first postdoc, and I'm actually starting my next postdoc in September. And I switched my research focus. So I'm no longer just looking at the Holocaust. In fact, I've left a lot of that research behind, though I still have, anyway. What I've now switched to is looking at the new Christian right. And I'm looking at white Christian fundamentalists. And I'm looking at evangelicals from the 1960s onwards. And so for me, although liberty, again, I wouldn't necessarily say that liberty made me lose my faith. It certainly shaped my faith, and it worsened my faith when I had faith. But it has absolutely determined where I've gone and what I study and what I research. And now my bread and butter, is legitimately evangelical newspapers from the 1970s onwards, and, you know, sermons and promotional materials for different, you know, places, and news, you know, news articles. And so I would say that it's determined so much of my life, and in a lot of negative ways for a very long time. But in the same way that Kelly was saying, you know, to make something positive out of the BS that we went through, I think that I'm doing my best to do that.
I love seeing the trajectory of both of your lives, and that this moment in your entire life that happened has continued to bear good fruit. You know, has been able to, you've been able to make it positive in quite a few ways. And I can only imagine that you've had amazing people with you that have enabled you to get this far. We're out of time, but my last question is, how have those people actually gotten involved in this, if at all, if you can think of a person or anything? We always want to empower people listening. How can listeners get involved? How can they have any impact on the case, or you know, what's happening on campuses today, or even if it is happening to them, you know?
Well, they should follow REAP on all those. Yeah, there you go. On all the socials, REAP_LGBTQ. But really, the reason, if we want to talk about a selfish reason why for folks, is because your taxpayer dollars are funding discrimination. So you should care about that. You should care about where your money goes. But for non-selfish reasons, you know, I think a lot of us in the past, or I've seen people in the past, like, kind of point to the church, you know, big C church at large as a big part of the problem with American politics and systems and things like that. Really, we need to, like, that is, yes, that's an issue, but what we need to really start looking at are religious educational institutions as the root causes of things like white Christian nationalism. Where do we get our politicians? Where do we get our judges? Where do we get our doctors who don't practice gender-affirming care? Where do we get teachers? And we get them from these religious educational institutions. And they're indoctrinated with this ideology of hatred, you know, of discrimination, of non-affirmation, non-inclusion, of exclusion. We need to take a good hard look at that. And a good way to support this work is to, you know, start there, start with REAP, because we're calling out those very things. That's it.
I think it's also important to note that these religious institutions almost entirely were developed to be an alternative to integration. Liberty started as an anti-integration institution. The school that I went to started a little bit later, but it was because of the, like, quote, liberalization of public universities, and they wanted to bring up pastors, but very intentional through white theology. And so that is, like, you're right, that is the history of these institutions. And the fact that we're not talking about that enough, like, these are the institutions that were founded to discriminate, and we're letting them to continue to discriminate.
Yeah, and
super, like, big deal.
And I can't think of very many organizations beyond us, honestly, beyond REAP, that call this thing out. So that's why people should get on board.
Yeah.
You know, and also caring about queer, trans, and non-binary students in general is just a good and right thing to do.
Yeah.
And Aaron, something that people always ask this question, and I think it's very much blaming the victim, but I think it is something to nonetheless address, because it is a question that a lot of people have, and it's something that we've not said. But one thing I do think about is, or that a lot of times people sort of, you know, question is, well, why are these queer students there? Why are they there in the first place? And of course, there's, like, a multitude of reasons, right? It's like saying, you know, like, why is that person, you know, in that country that discriminates against queer people? It's like, because that's the context in which they grew up. That's where they live, right? And for a lot of these people, the context in which they grew up was a religious, you know, background, a religious family, a religious whatever. And so community. And I think that there are people there who are there on scholarships and could not afford to go to university otherwise. There are people who are there who their parents will only fund their education if they go there, or their parents are, you know, really much essentially, like, twisting their arm to go there. There are people who are there who realize they're queer once they're there, right? There are so many reasons why there are queer folks at these schools. But just to address that, putting that aside, I think the way that people can get involved, I mean, I always wonder, like, who's listening to these podcasts? Like, who's the audience here? And I hope that it's everyone. Like, I hope that it's, like, straight people. I hope it's queer people. I hope it's whoever. But if there is someone who is queer and listening to this podcast and is not a part of the lawsuit, but they are a queer student on one of these campuses, write about it, right? Like, talk about it, share on podcasts, talk about the lawsuit there, write about the lawsuit there, right? Write these articles. That's how I got involved. That's how I first started in all of this. I first talked about it on a 3-minute thesis competition at my university. And then from there, I wrote an article for Queerty, just because I knew that the editor hated liberty. And so I was like, here we go. So it was a perfect connection. But, like, again, if you write an article and you raise awareness, and then you can, you know, weave in and out, you know, the narrative of REAP and what they're doing to address this, I think this is, like, the best way to do it. Or go on podcasts or start a podcast, whatever it might be. Everyone has a podcast these days, but, you know, it's my next goal is to start a podcast. So I just think to myself, like, there's so much you can do, right? And again, like, following, like you said, on social media, and then also supporting and donating to REAP, like, these are all really important things that I think would help. And if there's any journalists out there, write about this, right? Like, cover this story and talk about it. And I think that these are ways that we are able to mobilize the specific narratives of the plaintiffs, but also the larger narrative, which is that these universities should not be discriminating if they are receiving public funds, period.
Well said, y'all. But thank you so much for spending time with us today. I really appreciate it. I know that it does take energy to open these old wounds and talk about this stuff. So I really appreciate it. And I know that folks listening are going to as well. And so I really hope that you guys find a way to take care of yourselves right now. we're gonna leave it at that. Thank you so much for tuning in. This podcast is brought to you by REAP, the Religious Exemption Accountability Project. You can find out more about Lucas Wilson on Instagram at Luke Slam Dunk Wilson, or look for his upcoming book, Shame, Sex, Attraction, Survivor Stories of Conversion Therapy. Find out more about Kaylee Hargrove at propheticimagination.org, and look for REAP everywhere online at REAP_LGBTQ, or the website thereap.org.
Fall's here, and so are incredible sales at Tanger Outlets. Find must-have handbags, footwear, and all the latest fall arrivals, all at unbeatable savings. Shop top brands like Nike Factory, Crocs, J. Crew Factory, Coach, Gap Factory, Old Navy Outlet, Under Armour, and even more brands you love. Save more every time you shop with deals up to 70% off. Tanger Outlets, always on trend, always on sale. Plan your trip at tanger.com.